It is time for us to bring in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat. Now, David joins us live on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast on the weekend and the following week. David also is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and of course his own website, themediabeat.us. That is themediabeat.us. And welcome to the quagmire of American politics, David Tarachuk.
Yeah, well, it's good to be with you again. It's been another slow week in the media world, hasn't it? It's been another one of those hectic weeks in the media world. It's what I think you really know, right? It's what you were hinting at when you said that there's something. Well, it's been something of a maelstrom. That's the word I keep reading about Iowa in particular, but just in general, I think there's a great sense of panic and frantic activity and the unexpected. I don't think anybody wanted Iowa to happen, but it did, and what a mess it was.
Well, it's not just that. If you would have taken, let's just take the last week, okay, encapsulate it, and let's say 20 years ago, somebody would have written a made-for-TV movie or a regular movie on the last week's events and in politics and in this country, people would look at you like, you're crazy, you're writing fiction.
Right. Another ordinary week in America of the second decade of the 21st century. Yeah, it's been quite a week.
All right. Well,
and, you know, at the same time, it happened to be the week of the State of the Union. By the way. I think one of the most telling remarks of the week is actually I've heard it from more than one source in the media world, media commentators and prognosticators about the likely course of our election. Because apart from everything else, of course, this is the general election year for the United States. But the comment was that the impeachment process. These wise commentators are all saying benefited Republicans more than Democrats, for sure. And then there's a pause and they say, to the extent that it affected the public at all. I wonder how much people are even bothering to keep up with these matters anymore. And I hear on the streets, because, you know, I have to, it's part of my cross-check against media thinking is to make sure I talk to the general public too. And I have to say that the impeachment process, you might have thought, would have grabbed people's attention. Maybe it did at times, but overall, I think it's already fading into people's memory as just some very stupid kind of posturing by our elected betters. And not really of any relevance at all, not least, of course, because it was all a foregone conclusion. So, as many people are saying, maybe the Democrats just made a mistake in going down that route anyway. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, didn't want to do it in the first place to initiate impeachment proceedings, but felt in the end that she had to. And all her misgivings about doing it have unfortunately come to pass. So it's a combination of frantic activity of a kind and a kind of all blasé on the one hand, but also just tired and cynical response from much of the public.
Well, you know, you things come so hot and heavy and fast in Washington, but you start off with the wrap up of the impeachment case. You have Mitt Romney being hailed as a hero. Geez, he wasn't a hero; he was doing the right thing. But I'll let that something else. You've got the Iowa meltdown, Then you have the Iowa results come in, and basically it's a standoff between two people the Democratic Party really didn't want to be a standoff with, Bernie Sanders and Mayor Pete. And then you have the DNC saying that they want to get involved and do a complete canvass. And then you have the folks in Iowa saying, no, you don't understand. This is our event. This is not your event. And then you have the president at the prayer breakfast, the president at the White House. You have Nancy Pelosi ripping up the State of the Union speech. I'm out of breath.
Yeah, well, breathless coverage has been the name of the game all week, too, of course. But some important things come out about media coverage, I think, this week. There's something really important to reflect upon from, you know, as far as the fifth estate, as it's often called, the vital role that the press does play. I mean, sometimes, yeah, we can be just breathless about our coverage, but at other times, you know, we've got a vital role to play in the whole formation and carrying out of public policy on behalf of the publics that we represent. I mean, we media people are in some ways the eyes and ears of the public. The big contrast I want to draw about the week in the UK and the week in the United States, there was, on the one hand, a unified British press boycott of number 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence, the center of government, as it were, when the government officials tried to practice discrimination, selective briefings of journalists that they liked, and tried to ban, they made them line up on a carpet, and they tried to ban the journalists that they classed as opponents of the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And the press's response was so interesting. All these political reporters who were brought in for this event, before they were divided into the two categories, decided as a unified body to walk out in boycott against this discriminatory practice. Which is an interesting piece of press behavior, solidarity that is not always expected, and certainly took the authorities by surprise. Whereas spin over to this side of the Atlantic, and the traditional thing that happens before the State of the Union speech every year is the president has the network news anchors, the major ones, in to lunch with them. And in this case, more selectivity, more discrimination. CNN was banned from this august gathering. They were not allowed in. And what do all the network anchors do? They go to lunch anyway. They don't care so much as their British colleagues do about press solidarity and the way that government can these days apparently try with impunity to pick and choose their friends and favor their friends and ban their perceived enemies.
Yeah, it's the press has to hold themselves responsible for certain things. I know you're put into a weird position where you want to cover things and you don't want to appear to not cover things. But sooner or later in this war of aggression that the White House has put on the press, the press has got to find themselves, and they have to fight back.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do. You need access in order to do your job. So obviously, when the White House bans you from attending events, then you're at a distinct disadvantage. On the other hand, there are still ways of doing a job. That's one of the things that's become clear. You probably followed this particularly closely because it involved radio. NPR had an extraordinary run-in with the Secretary of State. Mary Louise Kelly of NPR had an interview with the Secretary, and he blew up at her. And it was one of the worst examples of authority trying to browbeat a journalist that I've come across. He was just so vindictive about giving him a tough, probing interview, doing her job, in other words, and he got offensive and and you know, she told the world how offensive it had been, and then more retribution. NPR was not allowed to go on the next State Department trip overseas. And in that case, it was their State Department specialist who was banned from the plane journey. And then, well, the interesting coda to that story, I mean, it's a very unpleasant story, but the coda at the end of it is that that self-same State Department correspondent was the one who scooped the journalistic community with the news of our former ambassador to Ukraine, who was so horribly pilloried by the president and hounded from her job, has now resigned entirely from the State Department service. So you can still do your job, even if the authorities try to ban you from their premises, even or events that they've organized or journeys that they're taking. Journalists still have to do what they have to do, and even if officially you don't have access, you still have your contacts, and you just then got to work them that much harder to work against an oppressive and truth-hiding or truth-avoiding administration like this one.
You know, I yesterday I sat and I watched as some of the networks, and this is what I don't understand. I understand covering the president when he's got a major announcement, when they got guests at the White House. I understand all that. I understand that. But I do not understand why the press likes to pillar themselves. Yesterday, every network had Donald Trump in the White House basically saying what he said at the prayer session. And I'm saying to myself, why are they putting this on in full? This is the exact same speech he gave at the prayer session and basically at his campaign rally, which was disguised as a State of the Union address. And the media keeps opening the floodgates for him.
Yeah, and at that lunch, we've had, as we should have, we've had leaks of what was going on at that lunch between Trump and the news anchors, except for CNN. And one of the things that he made clear to them was that he was going to be, these were not the words he used, but he was going to be teleprompter Trump during the State of the Union. He'd be, well, Nancy Pelosi's words were sedated. What he would be, in his own terms, he would be measured. He would stick to the script, and he wouldn't be. Excuse me. He would not be the vindictive and triumphalist individual that we know him to be. And he did suggest pretty clearly that he was saving that. He was saving that for the following day. And that's exactly what we got at the prayer breakfast. And as you say, at a White House ceremony, if that's what it was, in the East Room. And that was something that, yes, everybody knew was coming. They were signaled and telegraphed by the president beforehand. And yet we still covered it live, as you say, with all the pomp and panoply that the media tends to give events coming out of the White House. And that's absolutely a case in which I think just a report off, without the fanfare of live coverage, it was all you needed. We can give the facts as discovered, in an off-the-record briefing, if they have to be. But you don't have to carry an event in order to ensure that the message of that event gets over. That was one of those news occasions where no coverage, or at least just very succinct summarizing coverage, was all that was needed.
Well, I just sometimes it's like the press can be their own worst enemy, and I realize that that there's a lot.
Oh, I think Trump is still still holds them as the worst enemy. So, but yeah, we don't do ourselves any favors when we stick so unthinkingly to old habits and just put on stuff because it fills the air, and that's particularly true of cable news, of course.
Now,
because they do have to fill up so much space and time.
Have you noticed how the State of the Union address is starting to look and sound a little bit like the House of Commons?
Oh, well,
it's sad to me. I mean, now both
some of the raucous jeering, yeah, and the chanting was I don't think anything like what you would get in the House of Commons, but it was very much like a Trump rally, as you say. One of the interesting things about the British Parliament is that there are parliamentary standards, and at the same time as you have very lively debate and name calling, of course, it's all restrained by very very precise rules. For instance, you're not allowed to call anyone a liar in the House of Commons. Hence, Winston Churchill came up with a whole new phrase when he was criticizing somebody else's lack of truthfulness. He accused him of a terminological inexactitude. So there are limits to how raucous you can be in Parliament. But you're right. Congress is looking more and more vituperative and really. Well, I mean, decorum is the last thing we can expect of Capitol Hill anymore.
So now we get through we muddle through a little bit of what happened here, and I don't know. Now, listen, I have nothing against Mitt Romney. I not vote for him when he ran? Yes, but that's because, believe it or not, the deciding factor for me with Mitt Romney was the dog incident. But we'll get past that.
The dog on the roof of the car.
No, really,
forgotten.
You know, I just never could get past that. But we'll get past that. And now, listen, what he did was what he should have done. This is what I don't. He is built into being a hero, okay? This giant statue, for just voting what he thought he saw the evidence was there. He's not a hero. He was doing his job as a United States Senator.
Absolutely. In the world of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. In this case, in the world of no ethical compass at all, the man who seems to know what he thinks and votes accordingly is a rarity. That's what he is. He's a rarity. He's a minority of one on the Republican side. Whether that makes him a hero is questionable, but he's certainly very... he'll be an important asterisk, an important footnote when it comes to a review of the Trump administration's lifetime.
Well, he will. I mean, they compare him to John McCain, and I cannot compare him to John McCain. John McCain was a politician that I agreed with probably about 60% of the time, but John McCain was a hero not for what he did in politics. He was a hero for how he fought for his country, was captured, let go, and finally home, and took all of that and put it into a very wise and spectacular political career. That's where I draw the line. I mean, and like I said, there's nothing against Mitt Romney. What he did adds one additional component to the impeachment process, which was never there before with Bill Clinton, and that was a member of his own party actually voted to convict him. So I understand all that, but he was just doing his job as every one of these United States senators should do.
He will reap, no doubt. He already is reaping the results of that. I mean, he's going to be ostracized and decried by his own side. and it'll be uncomfortable. Except that, you know, in his home territory, he's pretty solid. And that's, of course, one major reason he was able to do it. He's somewhat insulated from the effect of the Trump gangsterism, which holds most of the Republican Party in thrall. I don't think he'll pay a terribly heavy price. He's not going to suffer that badly. I mean, I don't think we need to, shed any tears for his likely future as a politician.
Well, seeing as he doesn't have to face the electorate again for another two and a half years, in today's policies, that's a lifetime. This will be long gone and forgotten. But now, Jill, I did leave me a question, and I wanted to touch with you on this, getting away from mayhem in America, and that is about the former Scottish minister, and how long do you think that's been going on, and that people, the press has been on that story?
Some time. Scotland is barely covered in Britain. The behavior of the major newspapers for Britain towards Scotland has always been one of a kind of not even gentlemanly, just a kind of airy disdain for what goes on there. And it's as if it's another country. And of course, what's happened now, much more importantly than any particular scandal at any particular time with any particular personalities, is the overall movement towards a schism in the United Kingdom. Scotland is now heading towards, unavoidably, I think, a lot of pressure. The pressure is building, and we will see before long, I would predict, within the next 4 years, whatever Boris Johnson, as Prime Minister of the whole United Kingdom, might say, and he said it several times over, Scotland will nevertheless get its way in having a referendum for itself to become independent from the United Kingdom. And when that happens, then all bets are off for this latest monumental decision of the United Kingdom to leave Europe, because Scotland as an independent entity is almost certain to apply to the European Union for membership on its own. And then we'll get a whole new movement of the pieces on the chessboard. You get two elements of the United Kingdom, one in Europe and one out of it. And that's a much bigger thing that could be entailed now than any furore that occupies our front pages for a day or two.
I was going to say, what's going on there is a slow motion, either slow motion somehow success or a slow motion train wreck, because something big is going to happen one way or the other when this all shakes out, because it's not only a European problem, it's a world problem for other economies dealing with the EU and with England.
Yeah, and the pattern is repeating in slightly different, more localized ways everywhere. I'll do something now that I don't often do, and that's make a prediction. As you know, Ireland and Northern Ireland are subjects that are very close to my heart, and I spent a lot of my life reporting on them. Ireland happens to go to the polls tomorrow. There's a general election in Ireland, and I predict that in Ireland, you're going to see the extraordinary development of what was once a fringe party, Sinn Féin, the Republican United Ireland Party, will see their days at the fringe end. And they're already polling as the top party, the top political party, as Ireland goes into its general election this weekend. And when that happens, they may not have enough seats in the parliament to become the government of the Republic of Ireland, but they will be a very forceful presence, and they may be necessary to a coalition government, or they may just hold the balance of power in the parliament for a government that might be a minority government. So, you know, the reason that's happened, one of the reasons it's happened, is the whole mess up with Brexit in the first place. The border drawn across the island of Ireland way back in 1921, and the focus of so much violence and mayhem through the latter part of the 20th century, the Troubles, as it was called at the time, has all been about that border. And that border has gotten whole new attention now because of Brexit. And because people in Ireland are once again doing the opposite of what the peace settlement that ended all those troubles was intended to do, which is to essentially, in everybody's everyday life, forget about the existence of the border, essentially. It's now become an economic entity again. And because it's there, Sinn Féin, the United Ireland Party, has got a whole new stick to beat the opposition parties with. It's a opposition parties with. And as a consequence, it's doing really well. And my prediction is that they will become a real force in the land this weekend.
And is your prediction also that Varadkar remains as Taoiseach? Or?
We'll see. I think that's less easy to predict.
Ah. But oh, you like the easy predictions.
The balance of power will be, I suspect what's most likely is that Sinn Féin will be holding the balance of power. So whoever is Taoiseach will need the cooperation of Sinn Féin, the Republicans.
Well, you know what we've witnessed.
I want his Iowa prediction before you say anything else.
Go on.
No, Dave, is safe predictions, please. Who won Iowa? Sorry.
I think Buttigieg won Iowa simply in terms of the surge factor. He wasn't expected to be tying with Bernie Sanders. But I think that's an extraordinary piece of political campaigning on his behalf. It may just be, I'm going to be a little mischievous now and say that it boiled down to the fact that the senators who are running for office were all tied to their desks in the Senate chamber, and that's why Buttigieg did well. But it was spectacular, his rise up the ranks there.
And I think that spectacular rise, as we wrap up, of having the two top contenders for the Democratic nomination be Mayor Pete and Bernie Sanders, has really got the DNC shaking in their boots.
It is really it's very entertaining. I will say this.
They're getting what they deserve.
I'm definitely going to this movie. All right. Guess what?
We're out of time.
Thank you very much, David Taraschuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.